Welcome back to the Deep Dive, everyone. We are really glad you're here with us today because we're starting things off with, well, a joke, literally. Back in late 2015, there was this incredibly popular webcomic.
Oh, right, the XKCD one.
Exactly. And it poses this hypothetical scenario for a software developer. So a user asks for a simple app that checks their physical location, and the developer says, sure, that's easy, give me a few hours.
Which, you know, makes sense. GPS is standard.
Right. But then the user adds, oh, and also check whether the photo contains a bird. And the developer's response is the punchline. They say, I'll need a research team in 5 years.
Yeah, because just a few years ago, mathematically determining if a photo contained a bird wasn't just hard. I mean, it was the literal benchmark for an impossible task.
It really was. But today, building that exact bird classifier?
It takes, what, maybe a few lines of Python?
Exactly. A few lines of code. It runs smoothly on a totally standard laptop, and it finishes in under 2 minutes. So the technological barrier to entry hasn't just been lowered, it has practically evaporated.
It's completely wild to think about that shift.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if you are listening to this deep dive right now, you likely already follow tech. You know artificial intelligence is moving incredibly fast. But there is still this persistent illusion hanging over the industry.
The idea that you have to be some kind of genius to use it.
Yes. We often assume that to actually build these models, you know, to play the game rather than just watch from the sidelines, you need a PhD in computer science,
mm-hmm.
a mastery of advanced calculus, and like a multi-million dollar cloud computing budget.
Right, which just isn't true anymore.
Not at all. So our mission today is to completely shatter that illusion. We are delivering an audio overview on Lesson 1 from the acclaimed Deep Learning for Coders with FastDI and PyTorch framework. We are going to explore how you can shortcut the learning process and jump straight into the deep end of practical AI building right now.
And that shift in accessibility is staggering. I mean, it fundamentally changes who gets to solve problems in the world. We've been so conditioned to believe that deep learning requires this inaccessible level of elite resources.
Oh, totally. I always picture the world of deep learning as this really exclusive VIP club. And there's a bouncer at the door, and he's checking your calculus degrees before he even lets you look at a neural network.
That is exactly how it feels.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality of modern libraries like FastDI and PyTorch, it completely subverts that expectation. The doors have been blown entirely off the hinges.
I mean, I always assumed I was locked out of training state-of-the-art models simply because I don't have access to massive Google-scale datasets or thousands of dollars for GPU time.
But when you look at the source material, the numbers tell a completely different story. The requirements have just plummeted.
Right. You don't need petabytes of data anymore.
No, not at all. Record-breaking, world-class results have been achieved in various domains with fewer than 50 items of data.
Wait, really? Fewer than 50?
Yes, fewer than 50. And you don't need an endless budget either, because you can get everything you need for state-of-the-art work entirely for free using cloud platforms.
Right.
Things like Kaggle or Google Colab.
Wow.
And regarding the math, high school algebra is entirely sufficient to get started. When we remove those perceived barriers, we empower domain experts.
That is the core shift right there. Because a radiologist studying tumors or, say, a supply chain executive analyzing logistics, they shouldn't have to put their career on hold for a decade.
Right, just to get a computer science degree to apply AI to their own problems.
Exactly. They understand the nuances of their data way better than any generalized software engineer ever could.
Which raises an important question, right? If the technology has become this accessible, why does the subject still feel so deeply intimidating to the exact people who could benefit from it most?
It really seems to come down to our educational models. The reason deep learning feels so impenetrable is because traditional academic education approaches it entirely backward.
It's all theory first.
Right. The sources cite Paul Lockhart's essay, A Mathematician's Lament, which paints this incredibly bleak, almost nightmare world where music and art are taught the exact same way we currently teach math.
Yeah, Lockhart imagines this curriculum where students are forced to study sheet music, transposition, and abstract music theory for a full decade.
Before they ever touch an instrument.
Exactly. Before they are ever allowed to actually hear a melody or play a piano.
Mm.
Or in an art class, they're forced to memorize color wheels and the chemical composition of paint for years, but aren't allowed to pick up a brush until college.
You would completely eradicate any natural passion a student had for the subject.
Completely.
But that is exactly how most universities teach deep learning. They start with the abstract definition of the Hessian matrix, or Taylor approximations, or vector calculus long before you ever write a line of code.
Or see a model actually classify an image, which directly contradicts the philosophy of Harvard professor David Perkins. He advocates for a concept called teaching the whole game.
I love this analogy.
It's so good. When you want to teach a kid how to play baseball, you don't sit them in a classroom and teach them the physics of a parabola, or the exact friction coefficient of a wooden bat.
Or how to wind twine to manufacture a baseball from scratch.
Right. You take them out to a field, you hand them a bat, and you let them swing.
You give them the context of the game, you let them play, and they learn the mechanics by experiencing them. And that is the core philosophy of this Lesson 1 overview. We start by building a working model immediately.
Just jumping right in.
But I have to admit, jumping straight into the whole game can be jarring for people who are used to the traditional academic path.
Oh, absolutely.
The sources mentioned Dylan William. He's an educational researcher who uses a colored cup system in his classrooms. So green, yellow, and red cups on students' desks to gauge their real-time understanding.
And if a student is totally lost, they show a red cup.
Right. And I feel like if you come from a traditional bottom-up academic background, jumping into building an AI model without first manually deriving the underlying calculus,
it's going to feel like a room full of red cups.
Exactly. It feels deeply uncomfortable to execute code when you don't perfectly understand the underlying physics of every variable. So I'll push back on behalf of those red cups for a moment.
Okay, let's hear it.
Wait, if we skip the math and we just import a library and hit play on a pre-built model, aren't we just relying on a black box?
Yeah.
Doesn't that mean we don't actually know what we're doing?
It is a totally fair concern, honestly, but it sort of misunderstands the ultimate goal of the top-down approach.
How so?
Well, it's not about accepting a black box forever. It's about establishing motivation first. When you build a working model, you immediately see its value. You see what the inputs and outputs look like in the real world.
Right, you see it working.
And inevitably, that model will break or it won't perform the way you need it to. And that is when you go learn the calculus. You learn the theory specifically to figure out why your model is failing.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the math becomes a necessary tool to solve a practical problem rather than just some theoretical hurdle you have to clear just to enter the room.
Okay, so you swing the bat, realize you keep missing the ball, and then you go study the mechanics of your swing to fix it.
Exactly.
That makes perfect sense.
Oh.
But to play the whole game, we do need to establish the basic rules, right? We need to look under the hood. What is the fundamental engine driving all of this? Like, what actually is a neural network at its core?
To really understand the mechanism, we have to look back much further than most people realize. All the way back to 1943.
Wow, that early.
Yeah, with Warren McCulloch and Walter Pitts, they were a fascinating pair. McCulloch was an established neurophysiologist, and Pitts was this self-taught genius who's essentially living on the streets.
I remember reading this in the sources. Pitts was so brilliant that he read Bertrand Russell's Principia Mathematica, found a mathematical mistake in it, and actually wrote to Russell to correct him.
Yes, and Russell was so impressed, he invited Pitts to study at Cambridge, but Pitts couldn't even go.
That is wild.
It really is. And together, they theorized a mathematical model of an artificial neuron. They realized that a simplified model of a real brain neuron could be represented using basic mathematical addition and a threshold.
Meaning, if the signals coming in added up to a high enough number, the neuron would fire and pass the signal along.
Exactly. But the leap from a theoretical mathematical neuron to a machine that could actually learn from experience, that crystallized a few years later in 1961 with Arthur Samuel.
Right. Samuel was working at IBM building a checkers playing program.
Yes. And up until that point, the traditional way to build a checkers program would be for a human programmer to explicitly hand code every single possible strategy into the machine.
You write endless if-then statements. Like, if the opponent moves here, then you move there.
Which is incredibly tedious. And it's fundamentally limited by the human programmer's own skill level at checkers.
Because a machine programmed that way can never be better than its creator.
Exactly. So Samuel introduced a revolutionary mechanism. Instead of explicitly coding the strategies, he let the machine play games. He assigned numerical weights to different parameters of the game.
Like how it evaluated the safety of a board position, right?
Or the value of a king piece, yeah.
All right.
Then he allowed the program to automatically update those weight assignments based on its actual win or loss performance.
And by 1961, Samuel's machine played so many games and updated its weights so effectively that it beat the Connecticut State Checkers champion. A machine learned to exceed the capability of its programmer.
It was a massive breakthrough.
So let's translate Samuel's historical vocabulary into modern deep learning jargon, because I feel like the terminology is usually where the intimidation factor really kicks in for people.
Oh, absolutely. The jargon is the scariest part. But the fundamental loop Samuel designed is identical to the loop running inside modern AI frameworks today.
Okay, lay it out for us.
You start with your inputs, you combine them with your weights, and pass them through a model. That model generates results.
Got it.
Then you test the performance of those results against your desired outcome. Finally, an automatic mechanism updates the weights to make the performance better next time.
Okay, so mapping that to the terms we see in the FastDial library today, the model he talked about is what we now call the architecture.
Right.
The weights are the parameters. The measure of performance is what we call the loss. And the inputs are our independent variables.
Spot on. The vocabulary changes, but the architecture of learning remains the exact same. Inputs and parameters go in, predictions come out. You calculate the loss to see exactly how wrong those predictions are.
And you update the parameters to reduce that loss on the next pass. So what does this all mean in practice? It sounds exactly like tuning a guitar.
Oh, that's a great way to think about it.
Think about it. You strum a chord. Those are your inputs. The chord sounds completely horrible and out of tune. That is your loss, right? The measure of how far away you are from the desired sound.
Right.
So you reach up and twist the tuning pegs. That is updating the parameters. You just keep strumming, listening to the loss, and automatically twisting those pegs until the song sounds perfectly right.
It's an incredibly accurate way to visualize it. If we connect this to the bigger picture, it highlights the exact dividing line between deep learning and traditional software engineering.
Because there's no hand-coding the rules anymore.
Exactly. In traditional programming, a human being has to sit down and write explicit rules. Like, if you detect a sharp curve in the pixels, and if you detect a specific brown color, then categorize this image as a bird.
Which is impossible to do for every variation of a bird.
Right. But in deep learning, the network discovers what a beak and feathers look like entirely on its own. It does this automatically by turning millions of tiny tuning pegs through thousands of parameter updates.
And we hear the term stochastic gradient descent thrown around constantly to describe how those pegs are turned. What is the physical mechanism there? Like, how does the computer actually know which way to turn the pegs to lower the loss?
Okay, imagine you are blindfolded, standing somewhere on a highly rugged, uneven mountain range.
Okay, I'm blindfolded on a mountain.
Your goal is to find the absolute lowest point in the valley, but you can't see the landscape. All you can do is feel the slope of the ground directly under your feet.
Right.
If the ground under your left foot tilts downward, you take a small step in that direction. You reassess the slope, and you take another step downward.
And you just keep taking steps downward, feeling the slope each time until the ground eventually flattens out at the bottom of the valley.
That is stochastic gradient descent. The mountain is the loss landscape, a mathematical representation of how wrong your model is.
And the coordinates you are stepping through represent your parameter values.
Exactly. The mathematical operation of calculating the gradient just tells the computer which direction is down. It automatically finds the exact direction to tweak every single parameter to make the loss smaller.
Step by step.
Step by step, until your model's predictions are as accurate as possible.
And we repeat this process in cycles called epochs. We hear that word constantly. What is an epoch mechanically?
An epoch simply means the neural network has looked at every single image in your training data set exactly once.
Okay, so if you train a model for 5 epochs,
it has made 5 complete passes through your data, taking steps down that loss mountain and updating its parameters after looking at each batch of images.
Awesome. Okay, we have the theory. We understand the historical context, the loop, and the descent down the mountain. Now let's actually play the game. Let's return to the XKCD comic and walk through exactly how we build that "Is it a bird?" model to complete our lesson one journey.
It starts simply with gathering the raw materials. Using a basic search tool integrated directly into the code, like DuckDuckGo, we can automatically search for and download 200 pictures of birds and 200 pictures of forests.
And once we have our raw images, we use a concept in the FastDial library called a data block. The data block is essentially a blueprint.
Right. It tells the software exactly how to structure your chaotic folder of images so the neural network can physically process them.
And it performs 2 critical functions automatically. The first is setting aside a validation set.
And the sources emphasize that this is a non-negotiable safeguard. By default, the data block takes 20% of your images and hides them from the model during the training process.
It won't even let you train without doing this, right?
The software literally won't let you train a model without this separation.
I always wondered why it was so strictly enforced. Like, if more data makes the model better, why hide 20% of it?
Because if a model only ever sees its training data, it could just memorize the exact pixel arrangements of those specific 200 bird photos.
Oh, like memorizing an answer key.
Exactly. It wouldn't actually learn the generalized concept of what a bird is. The validation set acts as a blind pop quiz. It is data the model is never allowed to learn from.
It is only used to evaluate the model's accuracy after the fact, ensuring it can genuinely recognize completely new birds it has never encountered before. The second thing the data block does is resize all the images to a uniform shape, like 192 by 192 pixels. What is the mathematical necessity behind this? Why does the underlying math break if we leave the images at their original varied sizes?
It comes down to how graphics processing units, or GPUs, execute computations. A GPU is essentially a massive calculator designed to perform thousands of matrix multiplications simultaneously.
Okay.
But linear algebra has strict geometric rules. When we pass images into a neural network, we aren't passing in pictures, we are passing in massive grids of numbers representing pixel value.
Right, just numbers.
And if you are trying to process a large batch of images at the same time, those matrices must align perfectly. You cannot multiply a vector of 9 elements by a vector of 16 elements directly in the same batch tensor operation.
The dimensions have to match.
Exactly, otherwise the GPU simply cannot execute the parallel computation. So resizing ensures mathematical conformity.
That's total sense. So now we have our neatly organized, uniformly sized data split safely into training and validation sets. The next step is to create a learner. A learner is just an object in the code that binds your data together with the actual architecture of your neural network.
But we do not start with an empty brain. We don't start with random weights.
No, we use what is arguably the most powerful tool in modern AI, transfer learning.
Transfer learning is what allows us to bypass the need for a supercomputer. Instead of building an architecture from scratch, we download a pre-trained model.
In the lesson one example, we download a model called ResNet 18 that has already been trained on the ImageNet dataset. And that's a massive collection of 1.3 million images spanning 1,000 different categories.
Right. It has already spent vast amounts of computing power learning how to visually process the world.
And what's fascinating here is how the neural network actually internalizes that visual information. When researchers slice open these pre-trained networks and look inside layer by layer, they don't find a jumble of numbers.
No, they find a structured visual vocabulary.
Exactly. The first layer doesn't see a bird or a car. It just recognizes basic gradients, you know, transitions from light to dark.
Building on that, by the time the data reaches the second layer, the network has combined those basic gradients into simple geometric shapes, like corners and diagonal lines.
And then move deeper to the third and fourth layers.
And the network is combining lines into complex patterns, textures like fur or bark, and even written text. It has learned a fundamental understanding of visual geometry.
It's incredible. So when we use transfer learning, we are taking all of that profound, generalized visual knowledge that the model already possesses. We take this brain that understands gradients, textures, and shapes.
Right.
Then we just slice off the very last layer of the network, the specific layer that categorizes the 1,000 original ImageNet classes, and we replace it with a brand new empty layer that just outputs two options, bird or forest.
This is the elegance of the system. We then execute a process called fine-tuning. We run our 400 pictures of birds and forests through the network for just a few epochs.
And the network leaves its foundational layers mostly alone,
yeah.
Right? Because it already knows what curves and textures look like.
Exactly. It just gently updates the parameters in that final layer, learning to associate its existing knowledge of textures and geometry specifically with the difference between a bird and a forest.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The sheer speed of this operation. Because we are only fine-tuning the final layer rather than teaching the model how to see from scratch, the computational cost is microscopic.
It's so fast.
In the source lecture, this entire fine-tuning process takes under 30 seconds.
Wow.
This is happening on a standard presentation laptop without any specialized hardware cooling while the presenter is simultaneously streaming video. And at the end of those 30 seconds, the model hits 100% accuracy on the validation set.
It is the ultimate testament to the progress of the field. A problem that was literally the punchline of a joke about the limits of computer science in 2015 is now solved flawlessly on consumer hardware in half a minute.
So, what does this all mean for you listening right now? Whether you are a business executive looking to automate a logistics workflow, a software developer wanting to integrate categorization into a new app, or just an insanely curious learner exploring the boundaries of technology.
The barrier to entry is gone.
It's completely gone. You do not need a decade of calculus to play the whole game. The underlying tools to classify data, generate insights, and build sophisticated systems are sitting right in front of you, accessible with just a few lines of Python and a foundational understanding of the inputs and parameters.
It democratizes the power of artificial intelligence. It takes the capability out of the exclusive domain of research labs and places it directly into the hands of the practitioners, the people who actually understand the nuances of the problems that need solving across various industries.
But, you know, as we look at this newly democratized, highly accessible landscape, it leaves us with one incredibly profound thought to ponder before we wrap up today.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Throughout this deep dive, we've explored how these models learn automatically from their experience with human-curated data. Photos of real birds and real forests uploaded by actual human beings to the internet.
The models are anchoring their understanding of reality on the organic data we provide them.
Exactly. But right now, because these easily built models are so accessible, they are being deployed constantly. They're generating more and more artificial images, synthetic text, and automated data of their own, flooding the web at an exponential rate.
Right.
So what happens over the next few years when the next generation of neural networks begins its training process by scraping an internet that is largely filled with experiences generated by other AI?
That is the big question.
Could this feedback loop AI training on AI-generated data fundamentally alter how machines learn to perceive reality, leading to a sort of mathematical echo chamber?
It's an existential question for the future of data science. When the underlying training data becomes increasingly synthetic, the definition of ground truth for the model shifts entirely. We call it model collapse, and it's something the next wave of engineers will have to solve.
It really makes you wonder how we will define authenticity when the next massive data set is compiled. The landscape is changing rapidly, but the tools to navigate it are in your hands.
Just waiting to be used.
Exactly. Next time you encounter a problem that seems mathematically impossible, just remember, you don't need the PhD to start building the solution. Just download the library, trust the process, and start playing the game. Keep diving deep into your curiosity, everyone. Thanks for joining us for Lesson 1, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.